Robin Hood Radio and the Robin Hood Radio Network is proud to present Leonard Lopate at Large, lively hour-long in-depth discussions providing overviews and context to topics usually covered in partial measures. His guests include leading thinkers, scientists, artists, economists, farmers, historians, authors, and politicians. Mr. Lopate is a Peabody Award winner whose numerous honors include 3 Associated Press Awards and 3 James Beard Awards.
Welcome to Leonard Lopate at Large. I'm Leonard Lopate. In this age of fake news, alternative facts, and distorted statistics, it may not come as a surprise to discover someone is trying to deceive us. And yet, when it actually happens to us, when it becomes clear that a loved one or a family member has deliberately misled or betrayed us, the result can be, to the victim, can be devastating. Journalist Abby Ellen was engaged to be married to a dashing naval officer, a doctor with a history of covert actions in national affairs, or so he led her to believe. Her new book, Duped, Double Lives, False Identities, and The Con Man I Almost Married, examines her personal story and those of others in the context of the cultural history of deception. It's published by Public Affairs, and I'm pleased that it has brought Abby Ellen to our show. Hello.
Hello.
When did all of this happen to you?
This happened in 2010.
And how old were you at the time?
I was 42.
How did you come in contact with this man that you call the commander?
The commander. I met him when I was interviewing him for an article. I needed to find a doctor to give me a quote, and somebody had recommended this man in private practice in California. So I called him, and we spoke, and we had a very nice, professional, cordial conversation.
And you, was this for the New York Times or one of the other publications that you have published in?
It was for the Times.
What did he tell you about the diet that you were researching?
He told me that the diets were these, it was about detox diets, and he told me they were in essence, can I swear? He said they were BS, is what he said.
Yeah, BS is fine.
BS. He said they were BS. And that, you know, adherence, they did nothing for you. And so I quoted him, but the story didn't run for a year, so I had to call him a year later to fact check to see if he was still in California or what he was doing. And he said, "I'm in the Navy now, and I've left California. I'm now living in Jacksonville, Florida."
Now, did that conversation, that original one, was it different from other routine journalistic assignments, a cold call in which you're looking for content?
No, that's what you do.
Well, did you sense any unusual connection, or was it just you spoke to an expert who gave you a lot of interesting information?
You know what I liked about it? I mean, look, you meet people all the time, and some people you connect with and some people you don't. We had a nice rapport. He was funny. And I, you know, so I liked that. We kind of jived on that level, but we spoke for maybe 5 minutes. I mean, 7 minutes. It was nothing that major.
But then you got in touch with him again.
But then I got in touch with him again. And he said that, you know, he had left his private practice and was in the Navy, and he was opening up a hospital for kids with cancer in Iraq and Afghanistan. And I was going back to school to Johns Hopkins to get what I call my second useless master's and in international relations. So I said, "This is a story that you're doing. Keep me posted." So he did.
And did your relationship start simply as email correspondence?
Absolutely, because he was keeping me posted on everything that he was doing. So he would give me these updates.
Is there something about that particular way of getting to know someone that can be conducive to being misled?
You know, it can and it can't, because when you are emailing with somebody and talking with them, because eventually we moved to the phone, you think that you're really speaking from the heart. It's very easy. I've always found it very easy to talk to someone on the phone. You become a disembodied voice. It's like the analyst chair. And so people tend to open up. I find people open up more on the phone. So I thought that he was, yeah, I thought we were getting to know each other slowly. You hear these stories about people who get to know each other slowly over email, over the phone. So I thought that was the better way to do it.
But it was getting personal.
It eventually moved personal, but not for a while.
So you were just doing business? You were keeping consulting him as a doctor?
He was not consulting.
Oh, he was telling you about the other things that he did.
That he was doing, because I was really interested in that. You know, a hospital for kids with cancer in Iraq and Afghanistan. That was a story. Mm-hmm. Beyond that, it was a story that he was doing humanitarian work. It was fantastic.
Was he talking to you from Afghanistan or Iraq?
I don't know if he was for real. He would, you know, eventually later on, he would call me from there and I would say, what are you doing? And he would say, I'll tell you when there's a secure line, you know, so he couldn't tell me. He might have emailed me from, I don't know.
What did he tell you about his former marriage?
His former marriage. He told me that he had met his former wife when he rescued her when she was held hostage in Iran. And I said, really? When were we in Iran? Because the dates didn't add up. Because that would have been in 1990. And he said, oh, you wouldn't have heard about it. It was a secret mission. And I knew that she actually had Iranian relatives. So he told me some story about her uncle and some kind of governmental coup. I don't know. But that's what he said. He rescued her.
Were you starting to feel any romantic feelings toward him? Because you had never been married.
No, I had been, what I say, pre-engaged twice. I had a few serious relationships, but I never really, being married was not my goal. You know, I wanted a partner, loneliness, companionship, all of that. But I didn't care so much about being married, which is why I'd never done it. But by the time I turned 42, I thought, okay, maybe I should do it. This man was like nobody I had ever been with. So I thought it was a good decision.
Did you find him appealing partly because he had all of these mysterious stories?
Yes. Yes. I don't like routine. I've been an independent journalist pretty much my whole career. I travel. It's a sickness on my part, the way I like to travel. He was jetting around the world. He was doing God's work. Yeah.
Do you think most deceivers tend to have a lot of charisma?
Yes, they do. They're smarter, they're more creative, they're charismatic, and they're charming.
You were writing that article about the diet in 2006.
Six.
But your first date with him wasn't until 2010.
Right.
Did you feel that you kind of knew him well by then?
And we had only started talking, really, in 2000 and the end of 2009. And then, I mean, we'd emailed, but yeah, I feel like I knew him.
And where did he take you on your first
date? We went to the Four Seasons. He said, let's go somewhere celebratory. We went to the Four Seasons. He was wearing navy whites. And, you know, we embraced as if he had just returned from Iwo Jima. And the bartender gave us free drinks. You know, it was like an officer and a gentleman.
And, he took you to the Four Seasons. Over the time you knew him, he always took you to impressive places.
Always took me to impressive places. Always. That's right.
So what did he tell you about his life and his profession then? He said that he wanted to become a brain surgeon but hadn't done that?
Yeah, he never got to be a brain surgeon. That was really interesting because he wanted to help treat or cure glioblastoma. And that's what Teddy Kennedy had, that's what Robert Novak had, that's what John McCain had, that's what they died of. My grandmother had a glio. So the fact that he was doing that was really, you know, important to me, significant. I mean, that was how I wanted somebody who would cure this. So I really liked that that's what he wanted to do, but it was sad that he couldn't ever get it together. He was never good enough. So he told me that that was the bane of his existence, and he was trying to set the reset button on his life.
He wasn't all that physically attractive. Did that matter to you?
He was not Richard Gere. He was not my type. It wasn't that he wasn't ugly. He just wasn't, you know, he wasn't a soap opera star, good looking, you know. I didn't care. At that point, he was good looking enough, and he was charming, and he was funny, and he was smart, and he adored me, Leonard.
And you say he didn't pull the great American disappearing act.
Which involves a text, a cell phone, email, and an inability to use them.
So after right. that date, what was the frequency of your contacts?
Every day. A few times a day. We were always in touch.
And met often as well?
He was living in, he was in Washington and still commuting to Los Angeles to see his kids. And then, you know, he went off to Haiti on a mission. He would always go on these secret missions, so I didn't know what he was doing. And I was in New York winding down so that I could get ready to move to Washington.
Now, is it fair to say that whatever else his deception was about, he wasn't after your money?
That is a fair assessment, but that would be money that does not exist. Although I was thinking about this
Because most of the times when we hear stories like this, right, it's somebody who ultimately is saying, listen, I need $100,000 for some project, and can
right.
you lend it to me?
He once asked me if I had a trust fund, and I said, I do not. It's funny because later on down the road when we got involved, I do own an apartment in New York, and I remember calling my lawyer and saying, is it possible for, if I get married, can someone get their hands on it? You know, do they then own it? And the lawyer said, no, it's yours. I said, what about credit card debt? If he has credit card debt, will I incur that? And he said, yeah, you could. Mm-hmm. So I was worried. I was worried about that. Yeah.
But that was one of would have been a red flag.
That would have been a red flag. I know that. I mean, your question was about what that was the only
because
thing he ever made.
Because people mostly get suspicious when it's about money,
right,
not when it's a matter of the heart.
That's right. But I was wary. I mean, I am still a journalist. I was still a journalist. There was this tension between being a journalist, somebody who figures out facts or tries to, and being a person in a relationship when maybe you're supposed to not research everything the person says.
And was part of his appeal the part that gave him credibility to you, the fact that he always took you to the best places?
You know, it's nice to be flown first class. It's nice to be I didn't quite – he would complain about money, though. So I couldn't quite figure out how he could afford these things. But, yeah, I liked
– because he was a Navy doctor.
They don't make a lot of money.
Yeah.
I learned all about the Navy. I didn't know anything about the military before that. But I thought maybe he had money left over from – he was in private practice in Beverly Hills.
Mm-hmm.
So he couldn't have been that poor.
What did he tell you he was doing at the Navy? What kind of medical work?
He was – well, in addition to super secret missions, he was also working with the CIA. He was off – he had been a Navy SEAL, as he told me. So he was doing all these things. He would – And I neutralized the bad guys. I mean, who talks like that? But he did. He would just have to do these secret missions, which didn't involve fists. I mean, he wasn't like The Rock. But I guess my assumption is that they involved syringes full of, you know, the poison.
But
the microfiche.
He even hinted that at one point he had to deal with Osama bin Laden.
Yes, he did. He did. He told me that at
wasn't
one point.
Wouldn't that be a red flag?
That was, I, you know, as I like to say, there were red flags, maroon flags, magenta flags. They were blowing.
Pink
in,
flags.
Yeah, they were pink. They were blowing in five different directions, though. Of course it didn't make sense. And I told him that from minute one. I said, that doesn't make sense. How could you treat Osama bin Laden? This was obviously before he got captured.
Mm-hmm.
I said, that would have gotten out. The president, Bush was president, he would have wanted that to be exposed to the world. Everybody, you know, because that would give the war credence. And he said the president doesn't know. And I remember thinking, I don't know what's right here. I mean, I don't know. Words are still missing from the Pentagon Papers. We have Homeland. We have Zero Dark 30. I don't know what's right.
But you did know that Osama bin Laden was 6'5", and he didn't seem to know that. Or at least he was very tall.
He was no, and I said that to him. I think he was 6'6", mm-hmm. I think. But he gave me the rundown of ailments that Osama bin Laden allegedly had, which you could Google anywhere, but he told me what he had. And I said to him, listen, he's 6'5".
Hmm.
And he said, or 6'6". And I said, you would know. And he said to me, they all look alike.
Hmm.
They all look alike.
Why did you feel the need to tell him that you were thinking about adopting a child?
Because, God, this is like being in therapy. Because I was thinking about adopting a child.
Don't worry, you're going to have to pay me.
I'm just going to cry if I cry. No, I'm not going to cry. Because I wanted to. I was 42 years old, so at the time, which is old to have a kid anyway, and I never wanted a biological child, but adoption made sense to me always. So I had already put down money to adopt on my own.
And how did he react to that?
He said, "Great." He said he already had two kids, and he said, "You know, I'd rather have my own because I don't want to take on those kind of problems that could arise from that." But he was on board. And then we went actually in New York to visit friends of mine who had adopted a baby from Korea. And he said, and I quote, "I want one of those." So
did he ever introduce you to his kids?
Yep.
His ex-wife?
Never met the ex-wife, but I met his brother. I met his sister-in-law. I met their kids. And his son welcomed me into the fold. He sent me an email, which I still have, telling me how happy he was that his father had met me.
And how did your parents react to him?
He was a Jewish doctor. They were thrilled. They really liked him. My mother thought he was very good looking. They liked him. Mm-hmm. They were happy. They knew that I was a little too perhaps independent, and that I was
relationship shy.
Relationship shy, and I think they were happy that I was going to take the next step.
And what about your friends? Anybody say, this doesn't sound kosher to me?
One friend didn't like that they felt like he had left his children, and they didn't like that because he had left Los Angeles where they were and he had moved to Washington and Florida. So she didn't like that. Another friend who had been in the military said, that doesn't make sense. It doesn't make sense. And my mother said, and she liked him, she said, something's not right. Mm-hmm. And she said, who leaves a private practice in Beverly Hills? Nobody.
To join the Navy.
Right, to join the Navy. Didn't make
Especially
sense.
Especially at that age.
Especially at that age. But that was also what was so cool about him is that most people don't do that, and he did. I like that.
There was an article in the Times about why people believe in conspiracy theories and the like, despite all the red flags. Mm-hmm. And it's because you want to believe.
You want to believe.
And that was your case as well? You wanted to believe?
I was fighting with myself. And I would talk to my friends about this, actually. I would say, I don't know what's true. And they would say, well, maybe this is the lesson you need to learn. Ooh. Maybe this is the universe's way of telling, and I don't buy any of that universe stuff. The universe has other things to worry about than my love life. But I just felt like I have to learn how to just sort of trust, curb my suspicion. So that's what I was trying to do.
My guest is Abby Ellin, Ellin. Her book, Duped, Double Lives, False Identities, and The Con Man I Almost Married. This is Leonard Lopate at Large on WBAI, New York, 99.5 FM. How long had you gone out before he proposed?
6 months. 5 months. Five and a half, 6 months.
Now, he took you to all these great places. What about the engagement ring? Was that impressive?
Well, I like to say that I've had larger pimples, but that's not the point. I'm not trying to be a gold digger. It sounds wrong. That's not what it was about. What it was about was that he had made such a big deal about buying me such a big ring. And and I said to him, that's ridiculous. I don't need a $30,000 ring. But there's a difference between $30,000 and, 800. I mean, it was like that kind of thing. Something just didn't jive.
You were a frequent contributor to the Vows column in the New York Times. Yeah. How did it feel to be on the other side of the story?
You just nailed it right there. The word is story. It was a story. Mm. We had a story. I liked the story. I joke. I call that column Other People's Happiness, and there I am chronicling other people's happiness all these years. And finally, I was going to get it. And what a story it was. How we met, whatever. I really liked the story.
And I'm sure that you had thought over the years about other people's wedding plans. So did you have one for yourself?
Not really. We vaguely said we were planning to maybe go to Las Vegas. That's what we were planning to do in November of 2010. And the only thing I did was buy a wedding dress. Mm-hmm. And that, as I like to say, that was just about gross materialism. And it was, it was not that expensive. Like, I've gone with friends to buy their dresses, and they go to 16, 17 different places. I didn't have that kind of energy, and I didn't care.
Well, you needed something to match the ring.
I needed something to match the ring. Right, exactly. Exactly. So I was going to wear a slip. He never wanted to look at venues. He really never wanted to look at venues. I think in the back of my head, I said, I'm not getting married. Mm. I knew it.
But you moved to Washington, D.C. to be with him. Did you see him differently once you were living together?
I moved to Washington, D.C. I need to clarify this, though.
Oh, you were going to school.
I was going to school. I didn't move for a man. I just need to say that. What was crazy about that is we lived, where do you live in Washington, D.C. if you're about to be deceived? The Watergate. We moved into the Watergate, ground zero for deception. And yeah, we hadn't been in the same place. And when I moved in with him, it was a drag. It was not fun. He was asleep, or he would fall asleep early. He was up early, so I thought that was why. He would also scream in the middle of the night. He had screaming nightmares, which I'd never experienced with him before. That was from when he was held hostage in China.
At least that's what he told you.
That's what he told me. He was beaten and held hostage in China. And I said, when were we in China? And he said, you wouldn't have heard about it. A secret mission. And he escaped. And
it's amazing how many secret missions he'd been on.
Well, he really, you know, Jason Bourne. I joke, Jason Bourne, Steen. He was a regular, he was just a superhero in his head.
So did that start making you feel a little suspicious about things?
Yeah. I was suspicious, but nothing was verifiable. At Johns Hopkins, I would ask my teachers who were, some of them had been ambassadors, some of them had been, you know, presidential advisors. And I'd say, is it possible to have an operation, a medal for an operation that didn't officially exist? And they would say, yeah, it is possible. So,
but things, just so many.
But what better decoy than this little nerdy doctor, you know? it was crazy making.
What made you decide to break up?
We went out to dinner with my parents, and he didn't like that I interrogated him often about what he was doing. He didn't like that, and he knew I didn't trust him.
It forced him to come up with all sorts of inventive details.
Well, no, and beyond that, what it forced him to do was go on the offense. And that, if you think about it, that's what Lance Armstrong did. That's what Harvey Weinstein did. I mean, that is what Trump does. They go on the offense. And to me, that was now in retrospect, that was a clear indication that he wasn't telling the truth. But we went out to dinner with my parents in Washington, and he raved about the meal, and the Brussels sprouts especially, which is terrific. And then we got out, and he said, God, that was a terrible meal. And I remember thinking, you didn't need to lie. And so elaborately, what was the point? And he said, I just wanted to make them feel good. And I said, they didn't care. So I thought, if he could lie about that so beautifully, he could lie about anything.
But don't we all lie at times? For
yes.
example, you say, oh, that's such a lovely dress, or that you look great in that suit.
Sure. But do you go on for 5 minutes?
No.
About the stripes and the cotton? You don't need to go on. He would do that a lot. I mean, I can't tell you how many times he would use the word, what a treat. What a treat this is, when we were doing something with friends. And I thought, God, this guy gets a lot of treats in his life. It just, I'm always suspicious when anyone uses that word, actually.
After the breakup, which, as we said, you initiated, did you ever worry that you might have made a mistake?
All the time, until 2012. But beyond that, before that, yeah, I thought I probably ruined the best thing that happened to me.
But you're a journalist.
Yeah.
So you kicked into journalistic mode, you said here. How come you hadn't done that earlier?
I tried.
With all this secret stuff.
I tried, but because the word is secret. You can't verify what you can't verify. Who was I going to call? I mean, Leon Panetta?
You couldn't call the president because the president didn't know.
I couldn't call anybody. I didn't know. I did the best I could. His son knew. His son knew what his father was doing. His son, allegedly, he told us that the Secret Service was following us because the bad guys, quote unquote bad guys, were following him. And so because of that, he would have them keep an eye on his loved ones, which now included me. And I remember looking around and I'd say, you know, I don't see any Secret Service people. And he would say, well, no, that's the whole point. They're secret. You're not going to see them. And I remember saying, you know, well, next time have them give me a ride so I don't have to call a taxi, you know. And he didn't like that. But his son once called up and said, I see a black car outside the house. Is that one of your guys? So I remember thinking to myself, wow, if his son knows, presumably his ex-wife knows, so it must be true. Or else he's lying to his son, which is despicable. And that's what he was doing.
When did you start learning that some of the things he claimed weren't true?
March 2012, I picked up the phone, and it was Special Agent Dan Ryan from NCIS, Naval Criminal Investigative Service. And they are the people who investigated naval crimes.
I've seen the show.
You've seen the show. Yes, this was Mark Harmon, not. And he said, there's a doctor who's writing prescriptions for narcotics and Vicodin and also Cialis and Viagra. Do you have a prescription for the Vicodin? That was a felony. And your name is one of them. And I said, no, I don't have a prescription. I like Valium. I don't like Vicodin. And this is not mine. And he said, well, he's been using your name. and many other colleagues that he worked with at the Pentagon, and his dead mother and his ex-father-in-law and his aunt and all these names.
And what was he doing with the drugs?
Well, he was using, I have no evidence of this, but I suspect he must have been selling them too. I have no evidence of this. It's just my suspicion, because that goes back to your question about affording things.
Mm-hmm. Your friend's reaction to the information was that you'd been lucky to dodge the bullet. Is that how you
feel? That's what they say, right? You're lucky to dodge a bullet. You know, that's like saying you're lucky you didn't, you know, become a paraplegic after the bus hit you. I mean, if you were really lucky, you wouldn't have been on the same street as the bus. So I thought it was an unnecessary experience. I didn't need any more bad relationships.
But did having gotten into that relationship make you question yourself as a woman and as a journalist?
Maybe question everything about me, myself. What am I doing in this field? Why do I keep attracting people who are not good people for me, or good people in general? And maybe I should just be doing something else. Yeah, it did.
Later, when you spoke to doctors, one said, it's partly because you're an extrovert.
It's partly because you're an extrovert.
Introverts will be more questioning?
Introverts are not likely to strike up conversations with people. I will talk to anybody. I will, you know, I got an email recently from, I've been getting all these emails recently, and there's a part of me, a few years ago, I would have gone out and just seen what was going on. I like adventure. I don't like routine. I like mystery. So if somebody out of the blue called me up and wanted to meet me, I would go meet them in a public place. I wouldn't, you know, be mm-hmm. stupid. But I would do it, you know, just to see what the story was. Not anymore. Not anymore.
You've learned some lessons.
I've learned some lessons. I also think, to channel Nora Ephron, not everything is copy.
When did you decide that it was something that you wanted to write about? Because this could be rather embarrassing.
You know,
weren't you worried about that?
Was I worried about that? No one can say anything that I haven't said about myself.
Mm-hmm. So did you see it as something that might have been therapeutic, the process of writing about it?
Yeah, I thought it could be cathartic, but I also thought that it was... Every time I mentioned this to people, everybody had a story. They knew somebody who'd been in this experience. They had been in this experience. They knew somebody who was a liar, a pathological liar. So this had touched everybody. And a lot of people didn't want to talk about it. And that's what struck me.
You published a piece in Psychology Today in 2015. What kind of reaction did you get?
Huge. It was a cover story about betrayal, and I got all these emails from women and men, some of whom ended up in the book, talking to me about their personal experiences.
Well, you say in the book that even before your experience with the commander, you were fascinated with double lives.
Always.
But you didn't think that you could ever be duped.
I guess I didn't think I could be duped. And I like to say that in my quote-unquote defense, such that it is, I had a suspicion something was off and I left. Doesn't mean that it wasn't duped, because I was. But I didn't think it would happen. I'm too smart. Smart people get duped, though, just as much, if not more, because we think we're so smart.
You did a story for Marie Claire that involved a CIA agent.
I did. That was fantastic. I was dressed up by the guy from Argo and his wife, Tony Mendez, and his wife, Jana. And they dressed me up in a disguise, and they gave me fake teeth and a wig, and I had to go and try to fool people into not knowing who I was.
And what was the goal of that story?
Just to see if one could fool people. Obviously, they would have been better off getting, you know, Meryl Streep to do it, not me. But what gave me away, apparently, was my walk. I walk, apparently, like George Jefferson. I strut. So that's...
Yeah, but you had certain insight into all of this simply because of your own experience with the commander.
Well, that was before. I mean, that Mary Claire article had come out years earlier. Mm. But I think people see what they want to see.
Your agent said kind of advised you not to write about it or to discuss it.
I had been up for a couple of ghostwriting jobs, and the two people I met with for two different books said to me, what are you doing now? And at the time I was working on, I guess, the book proposal. And I told them I'm writing a book proposal for a book I'm going to do about my ex-fiance who lied to me and went to jail. And they thought there was something wrong with me. And the agent said to me, you really shouldn't tell people that story. you look like a fool.
Do you feel that's what happened? I think people are more fascinated than thinking you look like a fool.
I think they're fascinated, but I think to some degree, look, I hear stories. You know, did you see Dirty John at all recently? It was the fantastic podcast in the Los Angeles Times, and then it became a show on Bravo, huge, huge hit, and then a documentary on Oxygen. And you see it, and you see this woman being deceived by this man called Dirty John, and you know, there were clear signs. I mean, he had restraining orders against him. Her children didn't like him, and she didn't leave. She didn't leave, and you want to scream, what, are you an idiot? You know, it's very easy to look out from the other side and say, what's the matter? And I still do it, to some degree when I hear these stories. How do you believe?
This is Leonard Lopate at Large, Double Lives, False Identities, and the Con Man I Almost Married, published by Public Affairs. So, you did the article in Psychology Today.
Yep.
And then you said that you got all sorts of reaction. What kinds of stories were you hearing?
I got stories not only from people who had been deceived. Well, not only women who'd been deceived. I got stories from men who'd been deceived, by women, which frankly I was happy about because, you know, glass ceilings and all. So I wanted.
But we assume that most of the deceivers are going to be men.
Right.
Did women deceive in a different way? Are you generally not saying that they weren't married when they were?
I had this one story from a guy who wrote to me, and it's in the book, who had been with this woman for like 7 years. And she kept saying she was going to leave her husband. He knew she was married. She was going to leave her husband. They weren't, involved intimately. It was a terrible marriage. And it was all a lie. I mean, she had no plan on leaving it. And she would create these signs of, she created a fake Christmas card without her ring, without her husband, for my guy to believe that she was really on her way out. I mean, she was just manipulating the hell out of him.
Do you think that most people reading about a scam think, that could never happen to me?
Mm-hmm. They're fascinated by it. It's sort of like the train wrecks or the car wrecks that we see, right? And we all look and we're all fascinated, but they're cautionary tales. They wouldn't happen to us.
Where do we see it most often in our culture? Aren't there websites, careerexcuse.com and broapp.net?
That's right. Careerexcuse.com, you can go on there and you can get a fake resume. You can get a fake recommendation from a fake boss for a fake job you never had. You can go and get someone to answer the phone as if they're in a hotel that you're staying at. Then BroApp will offer an excuse. You're with your friends, or you're doing something important, so your beloved won't know what you're actually up to. There are very easy ways to obfuscate these days. You can get fake sounds of an airplane taking off.
Hmm. We mentioned earlier that we tend to think of con men or
con people
as trying to scam money. But how do you explain someone like the commander? What does he get out of it?
Other than getting to hang out with me.
but I'm sure he's done it with other people as well.
Oh, he was
engaged. His own kids, you said.
He duped his own son. What I later learned was that he had been married twice before. And I only knew about one. He had been married to another woman whom he ended up leaving when he met the second wife, not in Iran, but in medical school. Mm-hmm. She had never been in Iran.
Even though she was Iranian descent.
Of descent. But no, she'd never been there. She was born here. And as far as he was also engaged to another woman while he was engaged to me. Mm-hmm. And he left her. He had proposed to her in December of 2009. Right around the time he and I started talking or emailing more, she said yes. In February of 2010, he walked out. He said, I have to go on a secret mission. He left 26 bags of stuff in her house, and he never came back. Mm. And the secret mission was Operation Abbey. So what do I think he was getting? I think he had such low self-esteem that he just needed women, women, women. I think that was part of it.
It's a way of making yourself feel more important.
It's, because he really felt like such a loser because he had never become a brain surgeon.
Doesn't a journalist also have to deceive or mislead at times in the course of pursuing a story?
That's what Janet Malcolm would say. Mm-hmm. I I have sometimes screwed up stories. I've messed up stories when I've sort of told them too much what I am looking to do, because I don't like gotcha journalism. I don't like that at all. But you've
kept a diary of lies or deceptions you've made over time.
Sure.
So looking back at that diary, what did you discover about yourself?
I lie the way I think majority of us lie. We tell white lies. We say to tell someone they look better. I had some string cheese in my apartment. My friend came over and she wanted some. I told her I didn't have any. I don't know why. I think I lied in a... I lied in a spinning class at the gym. I told the teacher I got more points than I got. I mean, stupid things. Stupid.
But lies can be harmless, can't they?
But lies
can be harmless. Little white lies?
I am actually a fan of little white lies. I think that's what makes... From a stranger, I think that's what makes the world go round. I think that when I have... My good friends will tell me the truth, and I expect that of them, and I will tell them the truth, and I can't be any different. But, you know, if you're in your office and your colleague is wearing an outfit, she's already there and she looks like Yoda, and, you know, there's no need to tell her that, right? She's already out in the world. You might suggest she avoid brown velour in the future, but there are ways of doing it.
Can some major deceptions, double lives, also be justifiable? People who were gay at a time when it was illegal or knew it would cost them their jobs?
We
have to excuse that.
I think of Alan Turing. I think of Rock Hudson. Well, we have to excuse it, yes, except what happens when you're on the receiving end. I spoke to a woman who had a husband who died of AIDS. She didn't know that he was gay. She didn't know what he was doing, that he was going to bathhouses.
Well, I said getting a job. I didn't say getting married.
Well, okay.
There's a big difference.
That's a different. Yes, of course. I don't think what you do privately should matter with your jobs. You know, it doesn't matter. But yes, Alan Turing, I mean, look what happened to him, mm-hmm. right? So, and Rock Hudson, he kept this thing quiet. It's so ridiculous that even mattered, that he had to hide this. Who he was.
Except that he played these romantic roles. So he felt that it was important to come across as very masculine.
I know.
After the article in Psychology Today was published, you received an email signed by a Peter Jung.
Yeah.
Who was he, and why did he say he was living a lie?
Peter Jung was an animal rights activist with the Animal Liberation Front, ALF. And he released a bunch of minks from farms across the United States. And was wanted by the FBI. He got caught, and he was on the run for 8 years.
Is there a difference in his story and the commanders in that he sees himself as serving a larger cause?
Yes, but that wasn't why he's in there. We know why he was in there, because he was serving a larger cause. I was interested in how he pulled it off. What I wanted to know is how you pull off a lie like that for 8 years. And what I found out, which is what he told me and other people who are successful liars, is that you mix in fact and fiction, and you stay as close to the truth as possible, which is what the commander did.
He also had help from people, other animal rights activists.
Yeah, there was a network.
But doesn't even someone like him living a lie and a life that he's chosen also wind up deceiving the people he meets along the way?
Absolutely. And that's what was so interesting to me.
I mean, if you get romantically involved.
Yeah. There was this woman I spoke to who dated him for 2 years. She didn't know who he really was. Now, when she eventually found out, it made sense to her. It was one of those red flags. He didn't have a checking account. He never had a credit card. We were once going over the border and he was panicking. You know, that kind of thing. And she said that she felt... In a way, because she was also an animal rights activist, she understood it and she applauded it on the one hand, but she was also 22 at the time. 10, 15 years later, she was horrified.
He went to prison.
Does
he express any regret? Does he have any nostalgia for the things that he did?
I think he has nostalgia for living that kind of exciting life and doing this animal rights activism work that is so important to him still. I think there were many casualties of his lying and his deception, and he tried to get in relationships with people, and they didn't trust him.
Is he telling the truth now?
Who knows? I mean, I asked him that on the phone. He said, I am looking forward to finally unburdening myself to you. And then I saw an interview that he had done with someone else, and he said, yeah, this is really the first time I'm unburdening myself. And I said to him, hello, you're using the same line twice. And he said, well, but I'm really getting into it with you. So,
well, people justify all of this. For example, when they have affairs, they can say, well, I'm looking for a second chance, a better life, a happier life.
We justify everything we do. That's why we're not hypocrites, but you are.
I am?
No. I mean, I'm not a hypocrite, but everyone else in the world is. You know, I don't know. No, I don't think you are.
What is a liminal life? Is it possible to pull one off without leaving home?
A liminal life is what I think is, it's these lives that are sort of split in two. What we were talking about earlier with these people finding out that they have, you know, a second set of siblings around the corner. Mm-hmm. And the person at the helming that, who's perpetrating that, is sort of nowhere. They're not really fully in life A, and they're not really in fully life B. And I think there's something really sad about that.
They could be famous, like Charles Lindbergh.
Charles Lindbergh, he had family here, and then he had three separate families in Germany with two women who were disabled. They were disabled, which was fascinating because he was a eugenicist. It didn't make any sense, and he had kids with them. So I joke that must be why he took up aviation, so he could make the rounds.
And supported Hitler.
Yeah, and support, yes. Not a man you want to hang out with.
Is it fair to say that those lives contradicted the persona and personal beliefs that he was espousing publicly?
Yes, I think that's fair to say.
Do you think deceivers typically have an inordinate sense of entitlement?
I think they do. I think especially really smart ones, and most are, they're smart and creative. They feel like they have all the chess pieces and they have all the information, and in a way they're playing God with everyone's lives.
I've always wondered about the people who have published memoirs or autobiographies that turn out to have been largely inventions. In time, it's going to come out, isn't it?
Well, why wouldn't you just publish it as fiction? That's what I don't understand. But, you know, James Frye apparently had tried to do that. And the book, he was told this would be better. Since the book was loosely based on, or was supposed to be rooted in fact, they said, well, just publish it as fact. Mm-hmm. When, in fact, it was fact loosely based in fiction. So,
your former doorman told you about his previous life.
Everybody.
Suddenly everybody was telling you about deceptions?
Yep. Everywhere I looked, everybody has a story. My former doorman had been a drug kingpin. Prince Pin. Maybe mm-hmm. he wasn't at the top, but he was near the top. And when he came to work in our building, like, he had just gotten out of jail in prison in Iceland.
Were you surprised?
Yeah.
He hadn't actually misled you. He wasn't...
We weren't romantically involved. No, did he mislead me? No.
He wasn't telling people, I've never been a drug kingpin.
Well, I don't think anybody asked. It's got me. But his family didn't know what he was doing. He lied to them.
And do you think that he told you because there's a desire to confess?
Yes. 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 I'm like a rabbi.
How often are the deceivers psychopaths? And I'm wondering, thinking about people who tell little lies as opposed to bigger lies, is there a psychopathic spectrum?
There's a spectrum, and there's also the almost psychopath. You know, the psychopath is that you can find out, you can diagnose yourself with taking this 20-part questionnaire, which was from the Hare questionnaire, Robert Hare. And, okay, but what happens if you get 15 out of 20? So you have some psychopathic traits. Mm-hmm. What does that make you? An almost psychopath. It means that you can be a functioning psychopath. It means, you know, there's a spectrum in everything. Many studies have found that people who are really, really successful have major psychopathic traits. Sometimes they end up in politics, more often than not, at the heads of companies, CEOs.
No names mentioned.
No names mentioned. Actually, we have them on both sides of the aisle, left and right.
What makes it possible for someone to sustain an extended lie? Are there techniques for remembering exactly what you've told someone? Because that seems to me to be one of the big traps.
Is trying to remember all the facts.
Yeah, he told you, the commander told you he was doing such and such a thing in the year 1998, and then the next time he told you the story, it was 2001.
No, what you have to do is stick close to the truth. You have to stick as close to the truth as possible, which is, I learned this from Peter Young. He said that he grew up in one part of Silicon Valley when, in fact, it was another part of Silicon Valley. Those kind of things. You want to stick close to the facts, and you also eventually want to get to the point where you believe it yourself.
You can you describe what you call post-deception stress disorder?
Yeah. I everyone I know who's been deceived like this is just gobsmacked. They don't know how to make sense of anything, and they say it's a form of PTSD. It's actually post-deception stress disorder. I learned that from a woman who had been deceived, and she didn't want her real name used, so I can't give any hints about really who she is, but she said that it was just this traumatic experience to just be married to somebody, and it just, it was this PTSD.
Well, you spoke to his ex-wife and a girlfriend as well.
I spoke to the woman he was married to. Mm. I spoke to his ex-wife. I spoke to his ex-ex-wife. Mm. I spoke to the woman he was engaged to, and I spoke to the woman who was immediately after me.
And why do you think they agreed to talk to you? Had they all felt betrayed?
Yeah, I think the woman after me, it was really tragic because the woman after me had cancer, and he was courting her while he was with me. I found emails. And she, though, ended up, was instrumental in nailing him when the feds came calling, or when the NCIS came calling. She wore a wire. She has since died. But she didn't need to spend her last, 6-8 months dealing with this kind of nonsense. So I think she was happy to cooperate. I think the woman he was engaged to had no idea what happened to this guy. When I called out of the blue, that was the first she'd heard of him in, 4 years. Mm-hmm. The ex-wife wanted to make sure that I wasn't going to out him. She has kids. She's a wonderful person. They're all wonderful people. He has dynamite taste in women. And she wanted to see what I was doing. And I understand that. And she also, everyone has been so cooperative.
What happens to you when you discover someone has lied to you so extensively? Does it make you less likely to trust and therefore be deceived again?
You know what Reagan said, trust but verify. Mine is verify and still don't trust. I think that I don't know that I will. It's funny. I spoke to one woman who had been deceived by a mini Madoff. He was a very religious man, and he had made off with a bunch of money. And I said to her, how are you trusting again? And she said, I don't have the problem. He did. Hmm. Wasn't me. And I thought, well, that's really interesting. That's right. But what you have
wind up paying the price, as the owners of the Mets discovered when Bernie Madoff ripped them off.
Right.
And now all the Mets fans are paying the price as well because they didn't have enough money to pay decent ballplayers for
That's right. That's right. Well, what you have to do is, I think, be really vigilant in your own life. And that's what I will have to do. And if it means I'm not going to be involved with anyone else again, seriously, then that might be the way it is.
You also tell the story of Joyce Short.
Yeah. Joyce Short is terrific. Joyce Short runs an organization called Rape by Fraud, or Sexual Assault by Fraud. And what she's trying to do is get legislation passed. She believes that if you misrepresent who you are, then that is a form of sexual assault. So if I tell you that I'm, a lawyer, and in fact I'm, a handyman, whatever, and I'm not telling you who I really am, and you think this is what you're going, or if I tell you I'm a handyman and I'm really a lawyer, I'm not discriminating. Her whole point is you need to know who you're in bed with, and she thinks this should be a crime.
What's the difference between assent and consent?
Consent is based, from what I understand, it's the difference.
Is this a legal thing? Can somebody actually be prosecuted?
Well, in some places you can. In England, they were. In England, there was a woman who was pretending to be a man and having a girlfriend and having sex with his girlfriend using a prosthetic penis. And it's crazy. And blindfolded the girlfriend. And the girlfriend eventually took it off and realized that it was not a man. Now, there's so many metaphors there, right? Mm. Blindfold. I mean, but the perp went to jail. And there was also a case in Israel where somebody said that he was an unmarried Jewish something when in fact he was a married Arab something. And he had misrepresented who he was.
But that doesn't, there are no laws in this country along those lines.
Joyce is trying to get that passed. She's trying to get that passed. Certain states have. Tennessee has something, Indiana, that we're trying to get passed. they're trying to get past.
We mentioned earlier that this both sexes engage in deception. Yeah. But is either of the sexes more likely to be gullible? I'm also assuming that men are more likely to engage in this kind of activity.
Yeah, I think men are more. I think women, especially romantically, I think there's so much pressure on women to be married and to be coupled. And in addition to loneliness and the desire for companionship, which are very, very real. But I think because of that, and because it can be so hard to find a good partner, you're willing to put up with more than you might in other instances.
This is not uniquely human. Don't we see deception in the animal world
absolutely.
As well?
Absolutely. I mean, there's animals that change. There's the chameleons, which literally change color. But you see this in with birds. You see this with antelope. You see this in all... I mean. Chimps, they all have to deceive. Here's the thing that's so fascinating, though. Evolutionarily speaking, you have to deceive, but you also have to trust. That's the conundrum.
When you returned to Washington, you took part in a Spy the Lie workshop. Who ran it and what was the purpose?
It was run by a former CIA director and somebody who had worked for the NSA, Phil Houston and Don Tennant, and it was wonderful.
And who attends something like that? People who've been deceived?
No, it's actually, pretty much the first time they had opened it up to the public. It was mostly law enforcement people and me, and people who worked in like corporate spying to try and figure out if you can spot a liar. It's not easy.
Somebody recommended that you maintain a red bucket.
A red flag bucket, exactly. Where you put in it, when you meet somebody, things that are acceptable to you. Things that are, you know, there's a red flag bucket, and then there's maybe a pink bucket, you know, nuances. Things that are absolutely unacceptable that somebody will tell you, and then you put into another bucket the things that are okay that you can live with.
Now, the commander went to jail.
Yes, he did.
But you don't give us his name. Why not? Since it's part of the public record.
Yeah, it is. Because he has kids, and... I don't feel like they did anything wrong, and I don't think they need to. They've been traumatized enough, you know?
Are any of the names in this book, other than your own and those of historical figures, the real ones?
Well, Peter Young is real. Mm. There are a few others that are real, but I asked people. I gave them the option, and a lot of people didn't want their names in there for real because people are humiliated.
Do you feel that you've achieved some kind of closure as much as is possible?
Yeah, it feels like it happened to someone else. It feels like it was a story, which I guess it's become.
By making it into a story, you somehow have distanced yourself from the emotional pain?
Yeah, it was not fun writing it. I mean, it was pretty awful writing it. And it was, you know, I joke. My joke is monetize suffering, you know, which is sort of what the culture does. But it was painful. It was painful to write it. Now, if it just... to distance myself and make it seem like it was just something I watched on TV, which hopefully people will one day.
I'm assuming you've moved on to another project?
I've moved on to another project.
Are you able to tell us?
I've been writing scripts and I've been working on actually a play, not having to do with deception at all.
Although I would assume somebody's come to you with a proposal for a movie deal.
We're about to. I literally have to go and print something out and sign on a dotted line, and then we should be ready to go.
Who would you like to play the commander? I'm not going to ask you who you want to play yourself.
I was going to say I'm playing myself, but who do I want to play the commander? That is you know what? God, you talk about solipsism. I didn't even think about that. Who do I want to play the commander? Well, Richard Gere.
Okay. Well, he doesn't sound like you look like Richard Gere.
No, but that would be the irony. That's the irony. I mean, it's better than Woody Allen.
Abby Ellen's book is called Duped, Double Lives, False Identities, and The Con Man I Almost Married. It's published by Public Affairs. It's been a lot of fun talking with you.
Thank you so much.
And that brings us to the end of our show today. My great thanks to Abby Ellen, to Fran Higgins, who produced this segment, to Reggie Johnson, who was at the audio controls, to Charlie Morrow, who composed our theme music, and to my executive producer, Jesse Lent. Leonard Lopate at Large comes to you on Saturdays at 4 and Tuesdays at noon. You can subscribe to Leonard Lopate at Large podcast on iTunes and by clicking on Robin Hood Radio's archive program site, which is robinhoodradio.com. You can also check out Leonard Lopate at Large Facebook page. We hope to see you next week.